In the coming week, a major fuel pipeline from Canada to the United States could be shut down. U.S. Vice President Harris and Mexican President López Obrador meet to discuss migration concerns, and the EU and India are expected to revive trade talks. It's May 6, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, back in November, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer ordered Enbridge, a Calgary-based energy transportation firm, to shut down a major oil and gas pipeline by May 12th. Governor Whitmer got involved in the pipeline issue as Enbridge's Line 5 carries up to 540,000 barrels of crude oil and natural gas across Michigan and under the Great Lakes. Canadian officials and Enbridge officials say that closing the pipeline would cut off a significant supply of crude oil and natural gas that are used to make gasoline jet fuel and home heating oil throughout Ontario and Quebec. What's happening, Bob?
Jim, there's a set of issues that continues to build involving the United States, Canada, and fossil fuels. We can say it was kicked off by the very early decision by the Biden administration to discontinue the Keystone pipeline. That was going to deliver something like 800,000 barrels a day of fossil fuels into the United States from Canada. This is 540,000. It's not insignificant either, but it's a decision that we should note, though there are national ramifications, it's a decision made at the governor's level. It is the governor of Michigan, with the support of indigenous groups on both sides of the border, with also some friendly filings from at least a dozen other U.S. states, on an issue that has, I guess, been gaining concern on the local level on the U.S. side for a number of months and years for that matter. And it's now reaching ahead. It's basically the governor laying down the gauntlet and saying, this has to stop. We're concerned about the environmental impacts. There have been signs that this pipeline is on its way towards some sort of fracture that would cause enormous damage to these natural treasures, the Great Lakes, and it's time that we bring an end to it and come up with another plan. Canada, for its part, is saying, we value the Great Lakes as well. This is too abrupt. Let's work together on making this pipeline work better. But it's now sort of, it's a combination of things. It's the tensions at the province and national and local level in the U.S., but it's also U.S. and Canada, because Canadian officials have actually appealed to federal officials in the U.S. to help intercede. There's no sign they're going to do so. It looks like it's going to go through federal court in the U.S., although Michigan authority would say it should be handled by a Michigan court. And there's mediation going on since last month on this case. So I think, Jim, what you may have is we come to May 12th and there's still fuel passing through this pipeline, but the volume turned up highly by Michigan authorities about what needs to happen to, one, stop that, but also address the problem at hand. And so you're going to see a lot of discussion about the responsibility of both sides to deal with fossil fuels, but also to work hand in hand on decisions that are made that look like they're made to move away from fossil fuels. It should be noted this case is, I think, shining a light on the really integrated nature of energy supplies between the United States and Canada. They have a very close and extensive relationship, and it should be said these are energy relationships that involve primarily fossil fuels. But this particular line, Line 5 it's called, is a line that originates in Alberta. It carries fuel from Alberta's oil sands to Midwestern states in the United States, as well as to Eastern Canada. This particular line runs from Superior, Wisconsin to Sarnia, Ontario, and it connects refineries in both countries, and they make gas, propane, home heating oils, and so forth, as well as jet fuels for airports in Toronto and Detroit. They crisscross both borders. This particular part that's in question covers the Mackinac Strait. It's 4.5 miles, and there's a great deal of concern about that particular part and the potential for erosion of the pipeline and really leakage of the pipeline, and so much so that actually it generated discussion about building some sort of concrete tunnel. And a previous Michigan governor, Rick Snyder, had worked to make an agreement on that. There's now skepticism on the U.S. side about whether or not such a tunnel will actually be, you know, strong enough to do so. And again, it gets back to this question, Jim, of is there just a slackening interest in the U.S. creating infrastructure that will create a longer future for fossil fuels while the country seems to be moving more swiftly towards renewables?
I'll note, Bob, the irony of Michigan, the home to the big three auto companies, taking steps to close down a crude crude oil pipeline. But putting that aside, maybe you could sort of lay out for us why it is that the state is involved in this at all. Why isn't this a federal issue between the United States and Canada?
This is the crux of the issue. And as I mentioned, Canada would like it to be resolved at the federal level at this point. And Michigan authorities are asserting jurisdiction over this. And you have at the federal government, and it should be noted as the former Michigan governor, Catherine Granholm, is the energy secretary, who are not interested in taking this on at a federal level, but say it's a state matter. Now, it doesn't mean that won't be the case. And again, as I say, the Canadians are trying to litigate this in a federal U.S. court, and that could very well end up being the case. We could see some action next week, nudging in that direction, for example, although I think it's going to play out a little bit longer. But it's, as you sometimes see in this country, you have states asserting rights. And as a borderline state, which is, let's say, would be on the receiving end of any sort of major spillage, as it was back in 2010 when there was a pipeline rupture that contaminated Michigan's Kalamazoo River. Michigan is feeling extra sensitive towards this. Its governor, Gretchen Whitmer, is seized of this issue. Again, she's gotten the support of indigenous groups on both sides of the border and feels like she has a strong case to be made here.
But obviously, this is impacting U.S. relations with Canada. I know the Canadian government was very upset, both with the decision that the Biden administration made about Keystone Pipeline, but also the speed with which it made the decision, and that this has real ramifications for Canada and the Canadian economy. There's also another Enbridge pipeline, so-called Enbridge Line 3, which goes through Minnesota, actually designed to dead-end in Superior, Wisconsin. That is a bit of controversy as well. But this was a Biden administration that came in promising to work closely with allies, make common cause. But it seems like this is an issue that's really dividing Ottawa and Washington.
Yeah, it is, Jim. And again, as you say, it does seem like this is something that perhaps the two sides, again, because of the closeness of this relationship and the importance, it should be said, on both sides. While the Keystone decision really seemingly disproportionately affected the Canadian side in terms of jobs lost and so forth, this decision that's looming on the pipeline as it pertains to Michigan, you know, has impact on refineries in several U.S. states, as well as in Ontario and Quebec, as well as supplies in the U.S., as well as Ontario and Quebec. And there are other pipelines that traverse the border. This is a very big relationship between the two countries in terms of energy ties. You know, you're looking at a situation where you might still end up having the federal government step in and play a role, but I'm not privy to any sort of communications between Michigan and Washington at this point, but I think we could end up seeing that happening because it's such an important relationship. Again, Biden administration is just a few months old, but to have two big decisions like this looming that are extremely antagonistic towards normally a very close relationship are not good. I should also note it's happening at a time when the border between the two countries remains effectively closed. And that has had an ongoing impact, I think, in terms of, you know, both the human toll of families divided across the border, but also economically. These are borders in which lots of traffic has crossed over the years. Lots of commerce has been conducted. And this feeling of openness that, you know, the longest unfortified border in the world, as it's been known, you know, is all sort of feeling under siege at the moment. Obviously, COVID is the reason. But I think with this kind of decision, it's kind of adding to some tense feelings, Jim. And I think it is a time that there should be some federal, you know, discussion going on here.
Well, it is certainly the case that Enbridge Line 5 is a classic example how the U.S. federal structure can complicate international diplomacy, as well as an exemplar of how it is easy to talk about working with your close friends and allies, but how on a number of issues you can find yourself on opposite sides of the discussion.
Indeed. But there's another border, Jim, in North America that I wanted to turn our attention to, and that is the U.S.-Mexico border. Tomorrow, which is May 7th, Vice President Kamala Harris is set to meet virtually with Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, otherwise known as AMLO. A statement from Harris's office has noted that the meeting will focus on, quote, the common goals of prosperity, good governance, and addressing the root causes of migration, end quote. That last bit seemingly will be the focus of it. But Jim, could you give us a little bit of sense more of what we need to know about in this meeting?
Well, I would take a big picture view of this issue, Bob, and I think I would discuss the meeting in terms of the Biden administration's desire to want to get control, or at least get control of the political narrative on immigration. Immigration is clearly a political vulnerability for President Biden in his administration. We've discussed before the surge of people coming to the border since the beginning of the year, something on the order of 18,000 unaccompanied minors arrived at the border. There are something on the order of 20,000 23,000 currently in shelters. And we're not only seeing migration come from the so-called Northern Triangle countries, but also from Mexico as well. Now, some of this surge may be plateauing. There's some evidence to that. And a lot of arguments about whether the surge was really a function of sort of things happening seasonally and to what extent it happened because President Biden is seen by migrants and people seeking asylum as more open to them than President Trump was. The truth is probably a little bit of both. But back to the politics, the poll numbers are not particularly friendly to President Biden on the issue. His overall public approval rating is in the mid-50s, depending upon which polling organization you look at. But when you look at questions that assess his handling of various aspects of immigration policy, President Biden's numbers are in the low 40s. Now, it's not really clear what people are upset about, because people could be upset that he's not doing enough to secure the border. They could also be upset that they feel he's not living up to promises he made on the campaign trail. And the public is a bit conflicted on this, because while there's clearly evidence the public wants a secure border on the South, it also places a priority on making sure we have a humane immigration policy. Recent polls I looked at had 6 out of 10 Americans saying they want safe treatment of unaccompanied minors and that it's a priority. And 2 out of every 3 people being polled saying they want to see the Biden administration reunite families. So that's the political context of this. And as you know, earlier this year, President Biden put Vice President Harris in charge of working the immigration issue. It's, I think, on one level, an effort to try to show that the administration is taking this on at the highest level and that it wants to make progress on that. The question obviously has been, how do you do that? You start off with a broken immigration system and a broken refugee system, and you're facing numerous people coming north because they're trying to escape, whether it's poverty, violence, lack of governance, and what have you. And so the Harris-UMLO conversation is going to be largely about how to do that and what can be done. Now, on the Mexican side, I think it's safe to say that the UMLO government hasn't been particularly happy with the Biden administration. They're much more comfortable with the way the Trump administration approached things, because the Trump administration essentially said, if you keep people from coming, we will keep our nose out of the rest of your business. And I think the UMLO government is worried about the Biden administration, which has a broader view of U.S. interests in Mexico and how they might act. So they're going to have a conversation. It's not clear what the specific proposals will be on the table. It's easy to talk about how we have to address the root causes of migration, but it's a bit harder to define or devise programs that actually succeed in doing that. And again, if you look at the Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, they're racked by all kinds of problems: mismanagement, misgovernance, corruption, lots of poverty, climate change really affecting the ability of those countries to continue their traditional agricultural practices, gang violence, which is fueled in good part by America's seemingly insatiable demand for drugs and the rest. So this is a really complicated situation. And in many ways, I think the conversation, which is virtual, is going to really be about setting up Vice President Harris's visit to Mexico, which I believe is scheduled for June 8th, and she will go down and talk about it. So it'd be interesting to see sort of what specific conclusions come out of the conversation, if any, but also really to pay attention to the tone of the conversation. That is, are Mexico and the United States on the same page? Is it a meeting that produces some concrete steps going forward, or is it one where when you read the summit statement, you realize that a lot more divided the two sides than united them?
Yeah, Jim, I think that was a really good way of kind of walking through the real complexities here. It's hard to fathom, actually, the scale of things the two could talk about in a virtual chat. And I do think you're right. I think it's going to be setting up that visit. The vice president's office confirmed today that visit will be taking place, I guess, both to Mexico and Guatemala in early June. One could imagine maybe setting in motion something, a trip that might have some sort of important gestures or deliverables from the U.S. It's interesting to note the complexity of the U.S.-Mexico relationship, comparing the two administrations, as you noted, Jim. I think on the one hand, you had the Trump administration coming in from the get-go, talking about keeping out murderers and rapists from crossing and building a border wall that Mexico would pay for and so forth. And Biden, you know, sort of changing that tone, but also seeming to also acknowledge some of the deals that AMLO and Trump had worked out regarding the safe third country agreements and seeing how that had kept the volume of people crossing into the U.S. a little bit at bay. It will be interesting to see to what extent Mexico and the U.S. work out something that helps to manage the flow of migrants migrants in terms of processing asylum cases, in terms of keeping the Mexico-Guatemala border under control, things like that. I think it's all going to be kind of a lesson in sort of hemispheric policy coming up.
Well, it's certainly going to be, Bob. And I think one of the interesting questions is going to be, what will AMLO propose to Vice President Harris in terms of dealing with these issues? I know that AMLO has been a big fan of a tree planting program that Mexico has had in operation. It's something that pays farmers to plant lumber and fruit trees. It's, again, trying to find a way to keep people rooted to the land, to find ways to make their economies work. And AMLO has proposed expanding this program to countries like Guatemala and Honduras, in essence, to try to rejuvenate their economy. It's an idea that AMLO pitched during the climate summit that President Biden held last month. It's not clear how well the program actually works or how much interest the Biden administration has in it. You know, obviously, the Biden administration has talked about getting to the root causes, trying to build successful, functioning economies and polities in Central America, particularly in the Northern Triangle, because it's very expensive and gut-wrenching to try to stop people when they come to the border. It's much better, as the president has said, to do things that persuade people to stay at home because they have a stake and a vested interest in what's at home. But again, if you look at the challenges that the Northern Triangle countries in particular face, that's a daunting thing to fix. And it's not clear that we have the toolbox to be able to do so. Certainly would require a great deal of money. And the Biden team has at times talked about investing heavily in the Northern Triangle. It's not clear whether Congress will go along or that the money can be well spent given the real problems of lack of good governance and corruption in the country. It's one of these situations in which it's hard to see how you can quickly invest heavily and effectively.
And I would just add, vis-a-vis Mexico, it will also be interesting to watch the degree of COVID diplomacy that takes place. The U.S. has already indicated some sharing of large numbers of vaccines. The U.S. is in a strong position on vaccine production distribution. Mexico continues to be really struggling with its COVID outbreak.
You're right on that, Bob. I mean, the Biden administration did loan, it's called a loan for some legal reasons, millions of doses of AstraZeneca vaccines. And the Mexicans at the same time agreed to send more troops and police officers to stop migrants at the border, though both sides said it wasn't a quid pro quo. But obviously, that is a big issue there. But Bob, let's turn our attention to another set of conversations, one that don't involve the United States, but rather involve the European Union and India. They are expected to revive long-stalled talks on a comprehensive trade deal. As early as this Saturday, May 8th, the two sides are expected to announce the relaunch of negotiations that were suspended 8 years ago because of disagreements over tariff rules for car parts and free movement rights. So, Bob, can you give us some background on the EU-India trade relationship?
As you say, Jim, it has a history that kind of stalled out 2013 after several arduous years. And it must be said, anytime you hear about trade talks between really any region, but especially India and another major country like the US or a region like the EU, it is arduous. These are really tough. The Indians are notoriously very tough bargainers. And they have, you know, a protectionist bent as well, it must be said, about protecting certain key areas of their country, whether it's in the car area or agriculture and so forth. But they're back, and they're back for all sorts of reasons. A lot of the analysis I've seen about this, Jim, points to sort of what's happening both in Asia and in Europe. And on the Asia side, India is really keen to diversify its relationships and to bolster its relationships to strengthen its hand against China. China running its massive Belt and Road Initiative, but also the country that seems to be increasingly challenging India in its border region and in other areas. So India, as some of these analysts are saying, is looking for the strategic, you know, symbolic importance of this set of talks and in reaching even a modest agreement, the importance that means for India. Europe seems to indicate its interest in that as well. It has come up with a relatively new strategic posture towards the Indo-Pacific region in which it's newly interested in sort of being present. And the United Kingdom, recently divorced from the European Union, is forging ahead with its Global Britain campaign and is looking to also reach a major trade deal with the Indians as well as continue to forge strategic ties as well. So especially on the Indian side, there's a strategic symbolic importance. On the EU side, there is some of that, but there's also a move seemingly across the board to kind of ramp up trade talks. I think, again, in the aftermath of the Brexit saga, you have the EU moving forward seemingly with China, although that has now foundered on human rights and other questions, especially involving Xinjiang. But you also have the EU continuing to try to push forward some sort of deal with the Mercosur trade bloc in South America. And again, putting back on the table this set of issues with India, they would love to be able to be involved in the Indian car market, for example. The Indian market, you know, vast, its population just slightly trailing China at latest count. They would love to have more of a play in that part of the world and to sort of reach some sort of a common understanding with the Indians about a number of issues involving, you know, everything from cyberspace to even climate change issues. If they can get some sort of dialogue going with the Indians, they would like this process to do so.
I have to say, Bob, it's hard for me to see these talks going very far, very quickly. An obvious point is that India traditionally has had a very protectionist approach to trade. I mean, that's been an issue in U.S.-Indian relations. The Indians want to protect their home market out of the belief that that will stimulate economic growth and internal manufacturing capacity and the like. At the same time, India, as we know, is going through really hard economic times. Even before the recent surge in COVID-19 cases in India, the Indian economy was going backwards. All indications now are that the Indian economy is going to be set even further backward. That's not usually the sort of context which encourages governments to want to open up, because when you're less competitive and you open up, at least initially, you're likely to suffer more job losses. And I'll note that much is made of the size of India in terms of its population. I think it's important also to keep in mind that in terms of the size of its economy, India is quite small in comparison to China. The Chinese gross domestic product is nearly 5 times greater than India's gross domestic product, even though the populations are roughly equal. And obviously, India, given demographic trends, is soon to surpass China as the world's most populous country. So it's hard for me to see these negotiations making very big changes anytime soon.
That's all well said, Jim. I think what you're going to see in this virtual summit, so this is going to be EU leaders, some of them in person, some of them virtual, meeting in the nominally in Porto, Portugal, which is where the summit's supposed to be based.
A lovely city, by the way.
Beautiful. You know, you have the so-called Porto summit involving the European leaders, and then you'll have Narendra Modi in India. And I think one can expect there to be a great deal of talking in generalities and the symbolic importance of this process, and not so much on any sort of specifics, because as you say, the devil's in the details, and they are expected to be a tortuous set of talks right on down the line. It could be, again, small wins that end up coming at the end of the day. There, some people see some promise in the digital realm in terms of sort of setting up EU recognition of India's standards on data protection that would help make digital trade easier, things of that nature. Maybe Indian nationals, there could be some easing of their ability to work in the EU or for EU firms, things of that nature, Jim. But in terms of the big items, I mean, I would recommend people take a look at a piece that our colleague Alyssa Ayers wrote for our webpage about 10 different areas of U.S.-India trade that sort of are indicative of how the trade has both opened up but has been really difficult. You know, everything from Harley Davidson's to some agricultural easing here and there. It is a very difficult, painstaking process. There can be some rewards, but even with the most motivated individuals involved, it is slow going. And so, as you said, Jim, this will be a starting point, but I think you're not going to be seeing any sort of major announcements coming out anytime soon. But, you know, noting China lurking in the background as a factor, that could be helping to expedite some aspects.
What's most telling about this conversation, Bob, is that we don't see the Biden administration beginning these kind of talks with other countries, regardless of how tortuous they may be. And I think one of the great dangers of the Biden approach to foreign policy is that it's put trade on hold and other groupings are going off negotiating deals, which eventually have the potential to hurt American farmers, American manufacturers, American exporters.
It's a really good point, Jim. And again, I mentioned the activity on the EU front, and you're right, there are groups around the world holding these types of talks, mostly virtually, but not letting the pandemic slow them down. And the U.S. is not seemingly not in the picture for the foreseeable future. But Jim, I wanted to walk our way into the audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR_org. Jim, this week, our audience selected G7 foreign ministers meet. That meeting, I believe, just concluded. Can you tell us why it's significant, Jim?
Well, one thing off the top, Bob, is that they met in person. So we're making progress toward returning to some sense of normality on the diplomatic front. If you look at the readout from the meetings, I would say that China and Russia topped the list. The meeting seemed to be more about words than deeds. In terms of the words, there was criticism of China for its human rights abuses and for using its economic power to intimidate countries that have criticized Beijing. The discussion also had some harsh words for Russia, accusing the Kremlin of seeking to undermine democracies and threatening Ukraine. I would imagine that Secretary of State Blinken was happy with the outcome of the conversation. The United States got at least rhetorical unity, especially on China. You know, as we discussed before in the podcast, persuading countries to stand united against malign Chinese activities has been job one for the Biden administration. But beyond that, it's hard to see that the meeting produced much in the way of specific concrete action. There were some generic commitments to oppose China's coercive economic policies, to support Taiwan's participation in World Health Organization meetings, and to take steps to counter Russian disinformation. The other big issue at the meeting was the pandemic, not surprising. The ministers pledged to expand the production and distribution of COVID vaccines, among other steps. They didn't, however, endorse a waiver of intellectual property rights. And I don't know whether or not Secretary Blinken previewed the Biden administration's decision, which was announced yesterday, to waive intellectual property rights for COVID vaccines. If Secretary Blinken did so, then the other foreign ministers were very quiet because, as best I can tell, that news didn't leak in front of the administration's announcement. I'll just say on that because, you know, we touched on it last week. This is, at least on paper, a big change in United States policy. That said, there may be less here than meets the eye. Just want to point out that the Biden administration's announcement doesn't change anything for the moment. This issue of intellectual property rights is run through the World Trade Organization, which, as we've discussed before, operates on consensus. In a number of other countries, think Australia, think Canada, think the members of the European Union, think Japan, have yet to sign off on lifting intellectual property protections. The U.S. decision obviously increases the pressure on them to do so. I see that New Zealand has already announced it's going to follow the U.S. lead. But even beyond that, the actual terms of the waiver need to be negotiated. My understanding is that could take months, may even last until late in this year. And then, of course, there's the question, even if you get this agreement negotiated, how many companies and how many countries have the necessary manufacturing capacity, sufficient raw materials, and the relevant facilities to actually handle and distribute the vaccines? You may recall, and we talk about this often, that Pfizer and Moderna require special handling, special refrigeration that may not be widely available in many countries. And in the interim, you're going to see vaccine makers continuing to churn out doses of COVID vaccines. I'm seeing projections that manufacturers are set to produce something on the order of 12 billion doses by the end of the year. In theory, that's enough to vaccinate something on the order of 70% of the world's population. And the big question is going to be, will vaccine nationalism continue to get in the way of actually getting those shots in arms of countries that don't have or aren't home to big pharma?
Obviously, another aspect of this, Jim, was setting the stage for the big show next month, where you have President Biden on his first major international trip attending the G7 summit, and then he's due to attend straight after a NATO summit and possibly a summit with Vladimir Putin. It will be interesting to see whether the G7, which has sort of languished a little bit in recent years in terms of its purpose and its unity, whether or not this period of time and the challenges these countries are facing as lead industrial democracies, whether or not they kind of pull together over values, and whether you have a G7 united, maybe not always in lockstep in policy, but in terms of projecting values and in terms of whether it's getting behind human rights policies or rule of law aspects or whatever, Jim. I'll be very interested to see whether or not that follows through in the lead up and through the summit that takes place next month.
Well, we'll see, Bob. Time will tell.
And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. NASA's OSIRIS-REx spacecraft leaves the asteroid Bennu and begins its journey back to Earth. And Victory in Europe Day is marked.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. As always, Zoe Collis did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.